I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. We're going to start out with House Bill 2662 to accommodate Representative Frederick's schedule. And with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2662. Good afternoon. Welcome and identify yourself for the record.
We'll do that. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Chair Hovey, members of the committee, I'm Lou Frederick, representative from House District 43 in North and Northeast Portland. This is a district that has been hit hard by the recession and hit hard again by bank practices as economic distress continues to eat away at the hardworking people in my district. I come to speak about House Bill 2662, what I call the Good Neighbor Bill. I have been trying for as long as I've been a representative to create tools for cities and towns, not just inner city neighborhoods, but rural and suburban neighborhoods representing all income levels, to deal with the special challenges that have come up as a result of the intersection of economic distress and novel banking practices. We've all heard stories about the distress of people, working people, trying to navigate their relationships with big banks in a time of economic distress. That is not what this is about. This is about a simple problem made complex by the depth of the recession and by the fact that many banks decided to bypass and ignore the property recording rules that have been in place for a long time, a very, very long time. The idea that local government is the proper repository of property ownership records goes back to at least English common law. But since the implementation of the mortgage electronic registration system, many municipalities have found themselves without the simple tool of being able to contact a property owner to address problems with the property. But this isn't about MERS. That's a bigger can of worms for another day. This is about simply giving municipalities additional tools to address a persistent problem, the neglect of vacant properties. It puts the owners of vacant foreclosed properties on an equal footing with any other owners of real property as regards their responsibility to maintain a property so that it's not a hazard or a drag on neighborhood livability. My contacts regarding this issue have not only been neighbors of vacant foreclosed properties, often remaining vacant and neglected for periods of years, I've also heard from police agencies who are powerless to evict squatters when they can't ascertain who has the authority over the property, can't confirm that the squatters are there without authorization, can't find anyone to authorize police to take action on the property. I have heard from fire agencies where spring overgrowth becomes late summer tender and there's nobody to clean it up. I have heard from cities where there's a process to address neglected property, but it is stymied by the lack of recorded ownership. Normally, they notify a property owner that property conditions need addressing. Then, if there's no appropriate response, they contract for cleanup and bill the owner. They can't find anyone to bill. Many municipalities have had to eat those costs because unsightly conditions can change to hazardous conditions if left for a long while. Now, I'll admit that this information seems anecdotal. That's because it's even harder to find reliable statistics. Foreclosures do not seem to be tracked consistently across counties, and the number of properties in the same stage of foreclosure is, of course, far higher than the number that are currently bank-owned. In some cases, owners have been evicted before foreclosure has been completed, leaving them holding the bag for property upkeep without the benefit of residency. In addition, foreclosure numbers are currently depressed by the transition following the 2012 foreclosure law, but bank ownership of real property remains high. Currently, it is often difficult, if not impossible, to discover a live human being with decision-making capability or capacity or direct responsibility for a property when a bank owns it. In fact, it's often difficult, if not impossible, to discover the identity of a single financial institution that, quote, owns the property. And I do put quotations around owns because that is a puzzling concept when mortgages are securitized and subdivided and banks are connected in impenetrable consortiums. But that shouldn't negate their basic responsibility to keep up the property, to identify someone with that responsibility. I provided exhibits showing that the city of Hillsborough has done what the city of Hillsborough has done with their registry. A statewide framework would help other local entities get ahead of this issue. I've also brought a -1 amendment which clarifies that the obligations prescribed in this bill apply to vacant properties. I really thank you very much for hearing this bill. I urge you to amend it and pass it as amended to the House floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. and thank you for bringing this bill to us, Representative Fredericks. I've had a chance to read the bill now. I'm a little concerned because it says that you're going to post on the property the identification of who is the responsible party. But these are properties that may be subject to vandalism and other things, and so those that notification may get taken down. The burden is on the owner to make sure that they get replaced if they're removed. But the owner, as you said, it may be a national bank. They may not even know that's been removed. But if there is a time that it comes into neglect, the penalty that can be assessed is up to $150 a day for failure to correct. Well, that's $4,500 a month. Is it not possible that this could be really, you know, a kind of a punitive issue on those that are in violation that may not even know that they're in violation because they did post and it's gone? And would it not make sense to have the local government be able to correct and then charge a penalty and the cost of making the correction? They could contract it out and have it fixed up and then have that a lien on the property when the foreclosure goes through.
You know, Representative, that particular approach is something that we haven't really looked at. That's something I'd like to look at. But if you look at what Hillsborough has done, they have tried to make sure that they're posting some sort of comment, some sort of documentation on the front door of every property, because what we find is that it's often the neighbors who really would like to know who to contact about this kind of thing, and as well as the police force showing up at a house and not being sure what to do. So this is, we have to put in some way that it's easy to have the information there. And you're right, whether somebody might take it down and then and be responsible for it, let's work through that. But right now we need to have something, because the folks that I'm talking with are just tired of having vandalized properties and other things all around them, and they don't know what to do about it.
Well, thank you. Just one final comment.
Follow-up.
We will hear on another bill later from the Bar Association and how they're willing to have on their website foreclosure information. Maybe they would also be willing to have on their website information as to the parties who own properties that are in foreclosure, so that instead of putting a name and phone number, you could say information relating to this, the owner of this property is located, State Bar Association dot whatever, so that it would always be posted and always be available, but through a common website is another option.
Another option, and I haven't talked with the Bar Association about that. I go back to a point that Hillsborough decided that they needed to do something. They were in such distress.
It is a real
about
problem.
This, and you're looking at right now. I think one of the notes is that last in 2012 we were talking about 7,300 foreclosures in Oregon.
Yeah,
and in some places, we're talking. In Jackson County, the last number that I had was 288 foreclosures.
It's
inconsistent across the states, but we're seeing huge numbers. And again, people don't know. Many municipalities don't know what to do. Counties as well, because we're not just talking about cities. We're talking about farms that have been foreclosed, and no one's sure who's in charge of those particular farms. And suburban areas. I mean, the classic situation was the story of the brothel being started in one of the very high-end suburban areas around Portland. That was a foreclosed property, but the folks found out that it was foreclosed, so they went and took over and decided to do that. So we need to do something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Representative Lively.
So I appreciate the concern and share your the problems that this creates in community. So my questions around, so the communities themselves, so the cities, let's say in this case the jurisdictions, what under this bill they're required to do versus what they can choose to do. And my concern comes from a community that has dealt with a lot of these issues and for many years would take certain actions and then lien properties, and that what they learned over time, they weren't able to collect the liens, or the liens went on so long, and so it created a cost to the city that they weren't collecting, and so they just finally quit doing it. So I need to understand clearly what this bill requires communities do. I'm not, you know, I think there's obviously a lot of cause why you're suggesting doing this.
Well, you're describing exactly the part of the concern that I got from Portland and several other places, is that they would clean up. They would go and do a major cleanup. They'd have to, because it would be such a hazard, and then they had no place to really send the bill. The folks who had lived there had left because of foreclosed issues and needed to, and there was, it was unclear who they were supposed to act as responsible owners on this. Right now, the idea is to have that those municipalities would now have the ability to go to and find out who in fact was owner and go to them directly, rather than have to try to navigate a system that's pretty difficult, quite frankly.
Other questions for Representative Frederick?
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. I know it's a big issue, and hopefully we can figure out a pathway to find a solution.
I'd appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Kevin Christensen and Paul Rainey. Welcome, gentlemen. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
The matter goes, I'll fire away. Chair Holby, members of the committee, Kevin Christensen here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. We are opposed to the bill. There are several issues that we've identified in going back and reviewing the bill itself, and I'll just kind of go through them, and then I would like to offer a couple of just comments following up on Representative Frederick's comments. First and foremost, this is something in which nuisance laws are on the books in, as far as we know, every town, city, and I believe counties as well in the jurisdictions that would be able to handle this particular issue and take action with respect to them. One of the issues that could arise with respect to the bill is the fact that you could have a situation in which a state law is passed and all of a sudden you have a local ordinance that could be, I guess, preempted. It's not clear from this bill, but there could be a situation in which there's something that it would be akin to double jeopardy, if you will, in the sense that being fined twice, and as indicated earlier, there's some fairly hefty fines if this moves forward. Number two, if looking at the definition of owner as it's defined, there is some lack of clarity and some problems that at least our legal counsel has identified. I have not seen a -1 amendment, so I'm not sure if this may or may not be addressed within that -1 amendment. But in particular, there's reference to other instruments, which is, we're not sure exactly what is meant by other instrumentation that may contain the owners or what we're talking about. As counsel has talked to me about this, the issue is when you're talking about the name of the owner on the trust deed is the grantor, and so I think there's an issue that if the bill moves forward, that would need to be cleared up and clarified. With respect to ownership, obviously that is a somewhat sticky term, because prior to a foreclosure sale, the bank is not the record owner with respect to the property. They have a security interest in the property, but they are not the record owner, and there are implications that attach to that if they are to go on the property and take action, including trespass both in civil and criminal claims. There is a definition of neglect. There is a catch-all that we did identify as something that was concerning. To the point that was raised earlier by Representative Richardson with respect to the notice, I would caution the committee that in many ways when you post something on the door, it is in many ways an invitation for some folks to vandalize the property. It also acts, good or bad, as sometimes a stigma on the property when it is later in the bank's hands or in other subsequent owners' hands going forward. There is an issue with respect to, fundamentally, this is an issue of treating different property owners differently, in the sense that you have owners who have foreclosed properties who are going to be treated by this bill as opposed to others. And I would give the example that I think cars up on bricks or overgrown grass, it's not so much the owner, rather the foreclosed property, the nature of that that's the issue. It's the fact that there's a problem on the property. It's not specific just to those foreclosed properties. Finally, I think there was a couple of issues concerning identifying the property. I would suggest to you we had a discussion in the city of Portland over the last year with respect to this, and the city of Portland chose not to take action going forward. But one of the issues that did come up is identifying the property. And I would suggest to the committee, at least in the Portland situation, going to the website www.portlandmaps.com, which is actually a website run by the city itself. You can identify the owner by essentially, as I've been told, you click on the address, click on the assessor button, you get the information as far as property ownership, the record owner of the property, as well as the history and evidence of the sale of the property. So there is that. In addition, title companies produce things called trios, which are essentially a map, the last deed of the property, and at least in Portland, there's a MetroScan, which does identify the property owners. So again, we would caution the committee moving forward. There are some consequences to this that may not be what the committee seeks. So with that, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Mr. Rainey, would you like to go ahead?
Yes, thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Rainey. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Realtors. The issue of foreclosed residential property, unfortunately, is not a new issue for us in the real estate industry, but it is something that we are aware of, especially issues like this. We're interested in working with Representative Frederick to see if we can find a solution to this. To accomplish this, we believe that we need to narrow the focus of this and work within existing nuisance laws, but that is something that we're open to doing. Those are currently defined in ORS Chapter 105. But due to the broad nature of the existing legislation, we are concerned that it would have unintended consequences, which is why we'd really like to work to narrow the focus on this. And I'd also say I'm not aware of a Dash 1 amendment, but taking a look at that, that might address some of those initial concerns. But we would like the opportunity to work with him. So thank you. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. I'm actually curious, with the Oregon Banking Association, would you be willing to work with the sponsor of this legislation to help him?
Yes, we
create a product that could work for everyone?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, yes, we'd be prepared to move forward. Again, there are substantial concerns that we have, but that being said, I mean, I'm definitely not interested in closing the door and stopping dialogue by no means.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions from the committee?
So I have one. You know, you had mentioned the recorded owner and various places to find that documentation, you know, at the county, presumably. Is the lien holder also recorded in most cases?
The lien holder? Chair Holvey, I will clarify.
Besides the owner, you know, is there a place where you can find the lien holder, the existing lien holder, the security interest holder?
I believe there's a couple mechanism in certain instances where the MERS is not appropriate. I think you're going to be able to find it in the county recorder's office. The MERS website also has access to be able to look up that information, as well as the title company do it for you, and you can look that up. Or the case, as Portland indicated, they do have a mechanism for identifying them. So.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you. You mentioned the title companies having a list of owners. Is that information readily accessible? How do you make that request?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinney-Geyer, I think when I was practicing, for instance, it literally was picking up the phone call saying, hey, I'd like a trio, and within usually 15 minutes there was something faxed to me.
No cost to
No
that.
Cost, no. And again, Chair Holvey, just so that I'm clear, that's my experience with it. I don't want to overstate things, but that's my experience with the title companies that I've worked through. So,
thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your time this afternoon.
Try it out. So, a property that's vacant and try it out. I do this all the time.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2662. And let's open public hearing on House Bill 2528. Bob, can you give us a brief description of House Bill 2528?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2528 eliminates the $100,000 cap on value of real estate loan agreements subject to certain existing requirements regarding lender security protection provision.
All right. Thank you. Who's here to present on this bill?
Oh, boy.
Please sit and identify yourself with the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the moment, and committee members. My name is Paul Holby, State Representative, District 8. And I believe, I remember, maybe you'll know, this is a bill I brought forward personally, resulted from actually two constituent calls on this issue within a year, which sort of made me start looking at a particular issue. So the issue is specifically around loan agreements or mortgages that require interest escrow accounts for reserves for things such as taxes and insurance. And I was kind of startled by the issue when somebody called up say, so they're holding my money for a year to pay the taxes and insurance, and I don't have use of the money, they do, and I get no interest on it. I go, really? That's hard to believe. So I thumbed through the statutes, and I found, well, actually, they're required to pay interest, you know, on loan agreements. And so I just looked a little bit further and found out loan agreements were defined as real estate loans that were less than $100,000. And so I called DCBS and asked them, can you give me the reasoning or the history behind this limit at $100,000? Because in today's world, most loan agreements are well over that. And they looked it up and says, well, that was established in the early 70s and was somewhat of an arbitrary cap. And so I looked a little bit further, looked around the country, and many states require interest to be paid on the escrow reserves in these loan accounts, and in fact have no caps. As a matter of fact, I think Oregon may be one of the only states that actually puts a cap on the amount of the loan agreement where as a qualifier for paying interest. And so this bill the point of this bill is relatively simple, is I just eliminate the reference to $100,000 so that you know, on residential property, any loan agreement that has one of these escrow accounts is, you know, the people that put the money into that account and the bank sitting on it or the lender or whoever's sitting on that money to make the payment is liable to pay interest according to our current statute on those accounts to the owner of the money, actually. So that's this bill. Be happy to answer any questions if you have any, or try to.
Okay, just for clarification, the only thing this bill does is just removes the ceiling at $100,000?
I believe that's true, although, you know, there were some, as legislative council goes through and fixes some technical grammar, and, you know, I think that's the only substantive thing this does is remove the reference to $100,000.
Thank you. Are there questions?
In the definition of the real estate loan agreement.
Thank you. Are there questions for the carrier of this bill? See none. Thank you. It's very clear, very insightful,
easy,
concise.
Easy crowd.
Good to see you protecting the upper levels.
Oh. That may change his mind.
Right. We have on our list Kevin Christensen. Would you like to be heard on this bill?
Vice Chair Richardson, Chair Holby, members of the committee, I'll be brief, and hopefully the last time I have to come up here today. With respect to 2528, we do have some concerns. As Representative Holby, or Chair Holby mentioned, I think this has been on the books since the 1970s, and there are costs associated with sending out the interest that does come. I don't have a figure that I can quote to you, and especially in today's interest rate environment, that's likely to be a fairly small sum. Talking to our banks, I understand that a lot of what I refer to as kind of the reserve money that comes through is usually paid to make sure there isn't some kind of tax or other insurance that hasn't been paid, and so that's where it usually gets factored in. We would prefer, without question, that the cap stay where it's at. If the committee is intent on moving forward to this, we would suggest that perhaps a higher threshold be put into place. Whether that's, I don't have a number, but I'm happy to speak offline with Chair Holby and see if we can come to some kind of agreement. But there is a cost in terms of administration. In all candor to the committee, some of our banks have made a conscious choice to pay anyway. And so that is an issue. But I'm happy to work with the chair and see if we can possibly reach some agreement.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. intuitively, I'm struggling with this, because to me it would seem like the more money that is placed in there, the more someone would be inclined to want interest paid. Mm-hmm. Why was there a ceiling rather than a floor? Mm-hmm. A floor, it seems like that's not worth dealing with the extra cost. The ceiling, you want your cash. What am I missing?
Let me see if I can. Vice Chair Richardson, Chair Holvey, Representative Smith. I don't, from a historical point of view, I talked to our counsel who, Ken Sherman, as many of you know, who've been practicing almost as long as I've been alive, was actually not dealing with this bill back in the 70s when it came up. So I don't know the exact answer to it. I think, again, there's a what I call a temporary issue in terms of the interest rate environment now is going to be low. So even on a loan, let's say it goes up to $250,000, I mean, it's kind of pick a number that's sitting there. On a month-to-month, they're not going to be held very long. They're slight amounts. I'm not sure why there was a floor. I would just suggest that there's an administrative cost to do this.
Sure.
There are other, as I understand it, there are other entities. If you look inside ORS Chapter 86, there are other entities who are exempt, for lack of a better word, including OHCS. So I think it kind of plays out there. But I don't have a real precise answer for you as to why it was there. But I think our predecessor, Mr. Bronner, I believe, probably spent some time with it.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So, you know, administrative fees are covered. You pay a separate fee for the administration. I just went through a refinance. And also they hold back more than they think they're actually going to need, which is why there's interest paid on, you know, the extra that they have to hold. So both of your concerns about we want to make sure that we have the money we need to cover it doesn't seem to really answer the question of why would you not pay interest when you're returning the money.
Vice Chair Richardson, Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Guyer. Geyer.
Geyer.
Sorry.
I've
done it twice.
I like that French accent.
Talking to one of our banks, and I was trying to flesh that concept out, and the response that I got was reserves are only used when the loan-to-value is high, is what they reported to me, on the collateral, and you want to prevent an intervening lien, taxes in this case, or make sure there's collateral. The collateral is properly insured. That's what they've reported to me, so I'm not sure if that really answers your question so much, but I have to follow up.
No, really, because we're talking about interest on the money that they owe back after all expenses are paid. That's what I assume this is about. That's why the cap doesn't seem to answer that.
Isn't it? I believe this is relating to the entire amount of an escrow account for whatever time it's being held. Is that correct?
Chair Richardson, Vice Chair Richardson, Chair Holvey, yes, that's true.
And so that amount doesn't go down. Some of it does if you're under this 20%, you know, so that you don't have to pay these additional reserves. But if you've got taxes, insurance, and it's all part of an escrow account, that's your money that's being held and it's required as part of the loan agreement. Is that not correct?
Vice Chair Richardson, Chair Holvey, again, my understanding is when it is held, it is with respect to loan to value issues and preserving that. So I
okay. Representative.
Thank you. I just wanted to maybe make a couple comments, and I'm trying to think if I have another question for you while I'm doing that. But
I'm fine if you're hot.
I did ask DCBS the question about the floor versus the cap, and they also could not explain that. It didn't really seem to make a lot of sense because it's the cap's based on the actual loan agreement amount, not what's in the escrow reserves, and so that was for a large home, you know, that could be a large amount of money. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the constituent that complained was, at the upper end of the price range for valuation in homes in this particular area. And so it was a bit of money that was held in these accounts and that, you know, they felt was their money because they hadn't paid the bill yet, but they were required to pay it periodically, and so they felt like they should have interest on it. And so that's really what that was. And in fact, I've looked I've looked at information from the actually from the Bankers Association, looked around the country for other states. There's lots of states that require this interest to be paid, and I couldn't find any of them that had a ceiling on the loan based on the loan amount, or you know, and so that was, you know, sort of eye-opening to me that this was put in at a time when it was seemed to be somewhat arbitrary, and I'm quoting somebody, really couldn't explain the logic behind it. So, you know, that's what made me bring this forward. It just seemed like, in all fairness, that, you know, you don't get a lot of money, you know, in a savings account, but at least you get something. Mm-hmm. I think we still do, don't we? And I think correct me if I'm wrong, I thought of the question. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the rate that's supposed to be paid currently in Oregon law on these reserve accounts when interest is due is based on the discount rate at the average rate on the 91-day U.S. Treasury bill. I don't know if that's still current, but that's the information I found.
Vice Chair Richardson, Chair Holvey, with respect to the discount rate, I believe that is a statutory provision in Chapter 86, if I'm not mistaken. I can't quote it verbatim, but I believe that's what it is.
So that would be the interest that would be payable on these reserve accounts, is what I gathered from my research.
Vice Chair Richardson, Chair Holvey, yes, I believe that's correct. And I'm, like I said, I'm happy to circle around with you after, and the same with Representative Richardson and Representative Kenny Geyer. If there's anything I can get some clarification for, I'm happy to do so.
Okay. Well, satisfied my. Representative Vega Peterson.
No,
oh,
I'm
not the chair.
No, I was just going to hazard a guess that the reason that there's a ceiling and not a floor is that the bankers had a really good lobbyist in the 1970s when this was written.
They used to drink a lot.
Vice Chair Richardson, Chair Holvey, I choose not to answer. He did have an effective lobbyist.
We have no knowledge of that. Any other?
One final question is, do you have any idea what the total amount just roughly is that is held in escrow accounts, rather than us focusing on how much interest it is? If we knew what the total amount was, how many millions of dollars the banks are holding, then we could do our own calculation.
Vice Chair Richardson and Chair Holvey, I have no idea what that number would be. In all candor, I think that would be a fairly, I think there's probably some, just thinking aloud here, there's probably going to be some confidentiality issues that may very well climb up between. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure what the answer is, and I'm not sure
fine.
I can get that answer for you.
That's fine. Thank you. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close this public hearing.
Fascinating bill. Lost my agenda. That's a good idea. I'd like to open the public hearing. I'd like to open a work session for the purpose of introducing some LCs as committee bills.
Chair Holvey, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1407, dated 10-24-2012, LC 3328, dated 2-5-2013, and LC 3643, dated 2-18-2013.
Representative Lively moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1407, dated 10-24-2012, LC 3328, dated 2-5-2013, and LC 3643, dated 2-18-2013. Discussion on the introduction? Seeing none, is there any objection to the introduction? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. And I will close the work session. So what's next on the agenda, Bob? Okay. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2822. Bob, why don't you give us a little refresher on what this bill is, especially me.
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2822 specifically requires newspaper publication of notices of sale for real property.
Thank you. Up first, I'd like to have Daryl Fuller and Tom Gallagher. Good afternoon, gentlemen. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, not Frank Bronner, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. I'm here to talk in support of SB 2822. About 8 years ago, the newspaper publishers made an agreement with the Sheriff's Association, and that agreement allowed the Sheriff's Association to start up a website to post on it their notices for abandoned property and recovered property and so forth. And we knew at the time that it would actually get some of the judicial foreclosures. There were very few judicial foreclosures back in the time we did this. So we were happy to make the agreement with the Sheriff's Association. Since then, because of the MERS problems with foreclosures and the fact that the mortgage companies and banks are no longer using non-judicial foreclosures, which were always done in the newspaper, they all got siphoned back into the sheriff's website. I want to thank Daryl Fuller next to me for sitting down with us and seeing if we couldn't get back to the original agreement we made 8 years ago. Now, it's very difficult to get back to that basic agreement because you can't tell what's going to be a judicial foreclosure in today's world and what might be in the future a non-judicial foreclosure so that we could actually get the pieces back where we started. We introduced the bill while we were still talking to the Sheriff's Association and said that we should put all judicial foreclosures back in the newspaper and that they could put them on the Sheriff's website. When we talked with the sheriffs, they were careful to point out that that wasn't all fours on the original deal, and they would then lose the judicial foreclosures as a mandatory to go on their website. So we've agreed with them, and they will be bringing an amendment, which Daryl will talk about, which will allow the judicial foreclosures to be posted both in the newspaper and on the website. And when you fix the MERS situation on foreclosures, as I expect that maybe this session or maybe not, then we will be back to where we were originally. They'll get judicials, we'll get the non-judicial foreclosures, and everything will be roughly back to where it was when we made our original deal. I'll let Daryl talk in a second about his side. I'm not going to, unless you ask me questions about it, go into the value of newspaper publication in the local community, discussions on websites. We did a survey last November, statewide Oregon survey of over 600 people, and I have a great deal of data, accurate data, about where people look for notices, why they look, where they go, and so on. At some other point in time, we may have a bill in front of you over internet publication, and I will be happy to bring that forward. So where we are right now, I'll just leave you to say is that we're happy to have Daryl put his material back on his website. I will also say that all notices automatically go on the ONPA website, and that next month ONPA's website will be a new website will be opened by ONPA that models itself on the Public Notice Illinois website, which allows every notice that's put in a newspaper to be published in a newspaper and automatically uploaded to a statewide searchable data web base that can be done by locality or topic and so forth. So,
Tom, just for the record, sure. Could you identify what ONPA stands for some of us and some other people might be listening, might be wondering what that is?
I can. It's the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, and I should have said that. I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at that point, it's a good point for me to turn this over to Daryl. So thank you, and when we're done, you can ask us questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. When I took on the sheriffs, they told me I'd be spending a lot of time in front of the Judiciary Committee. It turns out you guys aren't the Judiciary Committee after all, which is good because I'm a little scared of lawyers ever since I married one. So I enjoy getting a chance to spend time with you folks. Historically, Notices were in newspapers because newspapers were the publication of record. There was no other option. Radio and television came along, and they really weren't a good source of those sort of notices because you had to be at the right place at the right time to hear them. And newspapers continued to be the source of records. As the internet became more and more popular, it has become a source of news and information for an awful lot of people. So we have a split, if you will, in where people go to look for information on public notices. My parents don't have a computer, never had one. They don't have the internet. They do subscribe to one of Mr. Gallagher's customers, the Herald News in Klamath Falls. They get the paper every day, and that's their source of news and information. And we think it's important on foreclosure notices that people that are in that generation and use that source of information that they continue to get the notices as they've always received them. On the other hand, people of my generation and younger may not subscribe to a newspaper and may not look at a paper version of a newspaper, and we look elsewhere for our information. It was because of that change in how information was presented that the Sheriff's Association a few years ago started looking at ways that we could provide information on sheriff sales and make it more available to the public. Our command councils, who are the people that do the civil part of the work in the sheriff's offices, were frustrated because they were constantly getting phone calls wanting to know what newspaper they needed to look into to get notices of foreclosures because they were from out of that area and weren't familiar with the newspaper. And at that time, a lot of newspapers weren't putting the notices on a website. Either the newspapers didn't have one or the website was news-based only. It didn't include public notices. And so we were spending a lot of administrative time telling people how to get a local copy of a newspaper. So we came up with the idea of creating a website that simply listed sheriff sales. It included foreclosures on real property, but also included personal property, items that were seized and other things. So we've created this website that has been very popular. We're getting more and more hits all the time, a lot of them from out of state. Again, people that wouldn't traditionally use the newspaper to get their source of information. Because of what happened in the banking environment, the foreclosure environment over the last two or three years, there was sort of a run on our website. We were getting a lot of postings that we weren't expecting, that nobody expected to happen because of what was happening in the environment. We appreciated the extra business, but that was not the business model that we'd created. But as we look going forward, especially as we're in the middle of this crisis and coming out of it, we think it's important that as many people as possible have the information they need on foreclosures. And so it makes sense to us to have a statute that would require the notice to be both in a local newspaper for those people that look for that information locally and on a website that is easy to find for people that are outside of that area. And so I've got an amendment request that I'll work with the committee on with the permission of the chair that clarifies the statute that says that notices for foreclosures would be listed both in a local newspaper and on the sheriff's website where people are getting accustomed to seeing sheriff sales notices. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Doherty.
I guess the same question for both of you. Is there a charge for, you know, I obviously put it printing in the newspaper, but would there be a charge for internet? And is there a charge in the sheriff's for somebody to post this? And then would there be a charge on the ONPA?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, yes, there is. We charge a flat $250 for a posting of 28 days.
Really?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, on the ONPA website, they go on automatically if you buy the ad in the paper. The ad in the paper will range 250 is a kind of in the low to moderate side. It's posted four times in the newspaper, so they're roughly the same.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Lively.
So one of the questions has to do with the whole purpose of publishing notices, and that is my understanding the purpose to some extent is to, quote, increase the competition, so maybe the bids. The person can get the maximum out if you're going through the sale. So is there any evidence that shows, demonstrates that the non-judicial foreclosure sales result in higher bids, or what's the result of the process, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, that's a million-dollar question. I deal with that a lot on different kinds of notices. So nobody's sure right now whether newspaper notices increase the sales or whether internet sales or double does that.
Mm-hmm.
What we tend to think is there are different kinds of audiences. So for many types of activities, you will have a special audience. There are people looking for foreclosed houses and so forth. If you Google foreclosure, you're going to get a large number of websites which people have uploaded different foreclosures for that purpose. So as you there are special audiences. Now there's also actual notice and constructive notice. And constructive notice is slightly different. Well, we think a general public notice in the community is involved in, however it's put out, is to deal both with the constructive notice to parties that don't get actual notice, and secondly, to inform the community as best it can. And right now, newspapers are still the best, most permanent form of local communities to get their information, and over time that may change. So, again, especially on for sale and auctions and other things like that, that's originally why we didn't have an objection to the sheriff's website, in a sense, because at that point it just didn't seem to us that posting it in the newspaper got the best audience for them. Now, I believe the term Tom, Dick, and Harry would apply, thinks they can have a website and split this audience up in such a way that I'm not sure anybody could find it. We just, for our website, the newspapers put in their papers references to their websites. We used advertising space of over $800,000 worth of statewide advertising. It made barely a dent in the number of hits on our website. The other thing I will say just on that, because you asked such a good question, is that when we did 2 years ago, we did the budget law, the posting of local government budgets, and we sat down with all the school district and local government people to put that together. We came up with a unique approach. We reduced what they had to put in terms of the budget in the local paper, and we put in that notice the reference to their local website. So especially on budget material, you can get a lot more material off a local government, city government's website than you can going to get posted, squashed in the newspaper. So that agreement was something I think is a model for going forward where we're actually advertising their website. So I'm sorry to be so long,
no.
Mr. Chair.
I like what he said.
Another question?
Sure. I just want to, so on the newspapers, and understand I'm a person that reads newspapers, so I'm not arguing with you about the value of that, but given the diversity of the state, and especially the diversity from the standpoint of coverage of newspapers, and I'd like to get some sense of, so what is it from the standpoint, is it the number of circulation, or what is it that would make it the value that they'd publish in certain newspapers versus not, or all newspapers, or where does that break down?
Historically, Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, historically, the mandate to publish notice has been in the statutes for a long time.
Right.
And I'm actually, in 20 years of doing this, have never brought in a bill to post notice. What I will say right now is that the 77% of Oregonians either read a daily or a weekly newspaper, they look at it, and our survey shows that about 70% of those people have actually looked at public notice. And I can give you some numbers which are on hits on websites. I mean, I could talk about the Oregonian Live getting 3 to 4 million hits a day and our newspaper website getting maybe 50,000 a month. So you can see that people haven't quite made that change yet. I can also say that newspapers don't go everywhere and that people can post their notice in a number of different papers. And it's a problem we haven't dealt with. If you go to find a cheaper rate and post it in a tiny newspaper published up in White City and not in the Medford Gazette, you're going to get less of the constructive and less of the community notice. That's a problem we haven't approached yet. I'm not sure that this bill quite is the place to do that, but I think over time, from a public policy issue, you guys are going to have to pay some attention to public notice in the changing media world.
Okay.
Other question, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I understand what is happening here, because I just read the bill. And it says that presently, it says the sheriff shall publish a copy of the notice once a week for 4 weeks in a newspaper of general circulation, which, by the way, could be a weekly paper in Rogue River that doesn't, but they make a substantial amount of their revenue from that. It doesn't have to be one that's the largest paper in the area. And currently, it says in lieu of publication newspaper under this subsection, a sheriff shall publish notice, and so it's in lieu of. So we've set $250 kind of minimum for most of the foreclosures I know, and $250 to be in yours. But the amendment is now going to come in, and you'll both be happy with this, and it'll say that we're just adding another $250 to the cost of doing a foreclosure, because now it'll be $250 minimum for the newspaper plus $250 for the sheriff's sale. And so what we're doing is adding a burden, a financial burden, onto the whole process instead of utilizing technology in a way that could make a change, even if in the newspaper it was to identify the parties and then refer to a common website or something like that, so you don't have to put the legal description and all those other things, which cost so much and takes up so much room. But anyway, if the agreement, am I correct that the agreement is now that it'll be both, and so essentially we're doubling the cost of a process for a foreclosure at this time?
Mr. Chair, Representative...
For public notice in the foreclosure.
Representative Richardson, vast trial experience and cut right to the heart of this chase. It is very difficult to put the Humpty Dumpty egg back together again. This is the best we could come up with. We would then have to parse out the notices to get back to where we were. That's between us. In terms of the general public here, what you're saying is accurate. I will say, I'd say a couple of things on that. There are differences in what you have to put in the notice. And there are sometimes people write notices that have meets and bounds, and they just take chunks out. There's no requirement that they post 18 column inches in that notice. And while this may be raising the fee for some of these and until the MERS is fixed, it's not forever, maybe raising the fee then, it may also cause people to take a look at how they post the notices and manage their notices right now. It has been our experience that mortgage companies and others are managing their costs right now by doing exactly what you said, not posting in the local community newspaper, putting in the weekly shoppers, simply searching for the cheapest place to put it. I don't blame them for that. That it's their money. But part of what we're talking about here is the value of public notice to your local community and what's the right way to do it. It's 2013. We're talking at statutes that are 60 and 70 years old, ideas that were put out in a different media world. This bill, we have no vehicle to fix what you raised, and we're just trying to glue an egg together.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Next, I'd like to call John Gere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm John Gere. I live here in Salem, and I have a solo law practice. And if any committee could have a groupie, I am your groupie, because I am an engineer and made my living as a business process consultant interested in efficiency and improvement, and I now make my living as a consumer protection lawyer. It's a substantial part of my practice, serving people who are being foreclosed, serving people who are being sued on debts, and so this committee is right up my bailiwick. I want to ask for two things. Take the opportunity of this bill introduction to start that conversation and form a task force to visit the question of the legal notice, public notice in the new world, the 21st century, and reject the proposal to double the cost of notices that are currently going into sheriff sales. The fact is that we have the legal equivalent of an appendix. It's a vestigial organ that had a function and had a very important function at one time, but that function is gone, and now the appendix can only hurt you. When it costs you a bunch of money and a trip to the hospital to have your appendix pulled out. Well, that's what our legal notice publication requirement in newspapers is today. The fact is that newspapers can and should, if they are true to their mission, publish every notice that is of interest to their readers without any legal, without any requirement to post it in a notice. And that what I invite you to do on a bipartisan basis, with full support from fiscal conservatives and progressives and everybody across the system, is to say we could have and should have a universal, publicly owned public notice system that merits or that meets the definition of constitutional notice, and that all legal notices will be placed into one system, and that, of course, the newspapers will continue to be free to publish all legal notices that are of interest to their readers, just as they publish the police blotter today. Nobody pays newspapers to publish. In fact, the definition of editorial as opposed to advertising is editorial is the newspaper making a judgment about what do my readers want to read. If these notices are important to the newspapers, and then the newspapers will publish them without having to be paid to do it. We can create a system that is a fraction of the cost, that provides much richer notice in multiple languages, with provisions for the handicapped, with provisions for alerts, so that anyone can put their own alert onto the system and get immediate notice if anybody in any paper anywhere in the state publishes a legal notice with their search terms on it. And we can use that money, even while slashing the cost for every taxpaying district in this state, we can generate revenue to support the legal system, just as is done with the interest on lawyer trust accounts. You just had a discussion, an important discussion, about who gets the money when a bank is sitting on a bunch of money. Well, in lawyer trust account, the legislature, and in every state in the union now, that money goes to support legal service programs and legal aid. The foreclosure crisis has been a terrible destructive force in Oregon, even as legal aid is laying off legal services attorneys. I urge you to create a task force to say what kind of a system should we have that can use the value created by legal notice to help fund legal aid so that we can restore legal services to the people of Oregon. I could go on and on. You have a handout from me, and I admire you if you'll read it. I took a substantial amount of time to read every newspaper in the state and see what they had to say about the importance of government innovation and government acting more like a business and being willing to revisit old ideas about how things are done. So I won't repeat any of that, but I just want to say that I'm open to your questions and eager to have this conversation about what kind of legal notice system should we have for Oregon in the future. I'd be delighted to answer your questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Do we have questions? Representative Kinnegar.
Hi, thank you. I'm just wondering what you're thinking. This is a very creative idea. Thank you. What you're thinking about the people that are not plugged into the internet right now?
Well, as you know, as you probably know, more people in Oregon have access to high-speed broadband internet than have access to newspapers. And newspaper circulation is declining dramatically. And the people who, as my one hand out in the charts of the Pew Memorial Trust study shows, people who want to reach the public with a message are fleeing classifieds in droves. What I propose is a centralized, publicly owned legal notice system so that with every contact in every government office, every library in the state, there will be a public website that has rich, valuable legal notices. And when offer low cost to any person who does not have internet, the ability to dial in. The technology is available today to put those same digital notices in HTML and on a website, to have the website be read to you if you call in and you're interested in, give me the notices for Marion County, give me the notices for this zip code. Mm-hmm. And you can have them in the language of your choice through your telephone. You can call them up on your cell phone. Mm. There's nearly 100% penetration of cell phone coverage in Oregon. Mm. And you can put them on the PEG channels. The same notices that are on the website. A website is a static public education and government channel, the cable access channels. Cable penetration is very high in this state, and you can take the exact same notices and put them on the PEG channels at almost no cost. So I can get you far more coverage at far lower cost if I don't have to go through the dead trees. It is the cost of printing and the monopoly on printing that is driving up the cost of legal notices.
Thank you. Other questions? I really appreciate your testimony coming forward on an efficiency issue, and I just want to make sure that I clarify that the interest on reserves in the previous bill is really separate from the interest reserves that you were referencing.
Oh, of course, I
understand. And I'm not trying to get those two confused.
Oh, I didn't mean to cloud those for people.
Yeah, that would be detrimental to that particular bill, I think. So. And maybe another bill. I appreciate your testimony, and I appreciate you coming here to voice your thoughts on it.
I thank you for the opportunity.
Up next, Pat Ehlers. Ehlers? Ehlers?
Yes, Ehlers.
Ehlers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Pat Ehlers. I'm an assistant federal public defender. I'm an attorney. I work in Portland. I'm not making any statements today on behalf of that office or any of the work that we do there. I happen to be a Board of Governors member for the Oregon State Bar. And for the last several months, I've been looking at the issue that you're looking at in this particular bill. And I can tell you that the Oregon State Bar is neutral today and just presenting information that you might be interested in as you consider this bill. The Board of Governors formed a task force recently. I'm a co-chair of that task force. And what we're taking a look at is whether or not we could, in Oregon, have a better system for legal notification. The task force is formed up with a number of different members coming at the issue from different perspectives. Persons that support newspapers, people that support internet-based notification. Let me tell you what you've got in this bill currently. You have an either-or provision. Vice Chair Richardson, you hit the issue directly on the head with your question earlier. Here is the situation currently. You can post notification of a foreclosure under the current provision under ORS 18924, and the judgment creditor can make a determination as to whether or not that notification will appear in the newspaper multiple times or on the sheriff's website. A better way of saying this is it's market choice. The market will determine what is the better notification, what is the least costly notification, and what is the most effective notification. That's what's currently happening under the current provision. The bill that you're looking at actually now duplicates effort, duplicates notification, mm-hmm. and duplicates cost. So you'd have to publish in the newspaper multiple times and on the sheriff's website if the bill, as suggested and proposed before you now, passes. My work on the task force tells me currently that wouldn't make a lot of sense. We were looking, as we formed the task force, for a better way to do notification, reduce costs, and make notification more accessible. The ideas that we're looking at currently involve a centralized, internet-based notification system that would, again, possibly look at the chance for market decision, having an in-lieu provision, which would allow for notification of all legal notices in the state of Oregon to be published in the newspaper or by choice of the person publishing that notice in an internet-based system, and probably, it looks like, at lower cost. The next meeting that our task force will have will be on February 28th. We'll be meeting at my office. The task force will be meeting in downtown Portland. And we're going to invite to the task force representatives from the state of Utah who are involved in a public notification system. In Utah, they have, it's my information now, gone to a completely internet-based public notification system. Not necessarily legal notice at this point, but public notification. And we've invited stakeholders in that process to come and speak to the task force by conference call and to walk us through their website to show us what they've been able to achieve in that state. So our work is ongoing. We've not yet reached a conclusion as to what might be the best solution. However, we're looking at all possible solutions. And what's been accomplished here with the sheriff's sales in its current form appears to be something that we're at least taking a very serious look at and might be going forward with in a proposal at a later point later this year. That's the conclusion of my questions. I indicated that I didn't have any written testimony because I wasn't pleased with what was put together before today's hearing. I only learned of this hearing yesterday. So I'll be submitting some written comments if the committee would give me leave, and Chair Holvey, if you'll give me leave to submit some written comments, I'd like to do that at a later point for this committee's work. That's all I have at this point. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Yeah, certainly we can accommodate your forthcoming, I guess, testimony, and leave the public hearing essentially open to accept that testimony.
All right.
For
thank you.
A week or so.
All right. That'd be great. Thank you.
So any questions of this testifier? Mr. Ehlers? Ehlers? Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to get it right before you get up. I appreciate your testimony. I'm sort of curious. It sounds like you've got the task force that the previous testifier was asking us to endeavor on, and certainly I'm glad you're doing it. Usually we have a hard time establishing task force in this building because they cost money. We have to staff them, and they usually get fail in the Ways and Means process. But I'm really interested in the outcome and your ongoing discussion on this issue, and I hope that the newspaper association is involved in your discussions and in your task force as well.
Well, we've got a number of stakeholders that I believe are involved in representing newspapers. The committee was put together as what appears to be a very credible group of people coming at this issue from very different perspectives in the hope that we'll reach a solution that will work for the state of Oregon. That's the basis of it. In answer specifically, though, Chair Holvey, to your question, just so that you know how this issue came about at the Oregon State Bar, there were some discussions early on among the Board of Governors that govern the bar, and then ultimately there was a decision made not to go forward, and then Mr. Gear, who presented previously just before me, made a resolution and presented a resolution at the Oregon House of Delegates, which is a governing body of the bar below the Board of Governors. There was a vote taken on his resolution to move forward with exploring this issue, and that resolution passed by what appeared to be, and I was present at the vote, a fairly significant majority of Oregon lawyers representing the entire Oregon State Bar asking for this issue to be examined. And that, I think, was the genesis of why the task force was formed and that we're currently working on at this time.
Thank you. And certainly if your task force branches out a little bit and you have some recommendations on our public notice, because it was such short notice for you, we'd be all there for that, too. So, not saying abide by your recommendations, but be interested to hear what they are. So with that, I appreciate you making the trip and giving us some information that we weren't aware of. So thank you very much.
Certainly. Thank you.
With that, no one else seems to be signed up for House Bill 28.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
I didn't have a question, but I don't have a question. I just have more of an observation, and I don't know if anyone on this committee can help me with this. As I think about the purpose of a notice of sale, the purpose of that is to inform, it's to educate, it's to notify, and to me, I'm struggling with who better to do that than newspapers of general circulation. Their job is to go out and to inform the public of what's going on in their community,
in their neighborhood. And to me, it seems like one goes with the other. The struggle I'm having with the internet is the internet to me seems like a great place for someone to go to search, but not to be notified.
So I'd be happy to address that. If you've ever had an item, any kind of personal property item, in the last 5 years that you've wanted to sell to another person, I would venture to guess that you've not placed an advertisement in the newspaper to sell that item. You've placed
it
on...
I live in Heppner, so be careful.
you've probably placed it, and many of the committee members here would have placed it on Craigslist, which is a centralized notification system for the sale of personal property.
I'm not meaning to get into semantics on a word, but I'm not sure it's to notify, but rather to serve as a placeholder where you can have your statement of notice.
Mm-hmm.
Notification means I'm going out and I'm telling you what's going on. A notice of sale means the sheriff wants to notify the citizenry, and they're going to use the tool at hand, and that's a newspaper. Where the internet serves as a tool to where you can go to get that information.
I guess then specifically on the issue of the sheriff's sale, you've got a great example in front of you and a success story that appears to have been going on for a couple of years now with the passage of 18-924. Because what you see is you've got a legal provision that allows stakeholders in the process of notification, people that are noticing and people who are receiving notice, using a system that allows them to either select the newspaper or to select an online centralized notification system. Mm-hmm. And what is actually happening is that the market is dictating and the end users are dictating that the notification take place more often and at less cost on the sheriff's notification website. It would be based on the success of other internet notification systems, for instance, Craigslist, not a venture to say that that success is going to continue and increase over time. So when you've got a system now under this current proposal where you would duplicate that effort and require publication in a newspaper and on the sheriff's website and cut out the market forces that would dictate which is the better system, you might, and again I'm neutral on this position, but you might be making a mistake to enact a piece of legislation like that.
Appreciate your time.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, for letting me share my thought.
You bet. No problem. Thank you very much again, Mr. Ehlers. With that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2822 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2568. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 2568.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2568 specifies the defaults to be listed on an amended notice of sale issued after release from stay on foreclosure proceedings, authorizes a trustee, trustee's attorney, or designated agent to postpone sale for one or more periods totaling not more than 60 days or the remainder of the 180-day period allowed for postponement remaining from before the stay, whichever is greater.
Thank you. Up first, we have Patrick Wade.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Wade. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Eugene. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar debtor-creditor section, legislative committee, and recently completed 7 years on the section's executive committee and past chair of the section. My practice focuses on representing primarily creditors in secured land enforcement issues, although I do represent debtors on occasion in workout situations. This bill comes about because of some ambiguities in the current statute about exactly how a trustee is supposed to behave with regard to a pending foreclosure that is interrupted by a stay such as a bankruptcy stay or a stay ordered by a state court. The statute as written provides that the trustee may resume the foreclosure sale, the non-judicial foreclosure sale, by giving an amended notice of sale within 30 days after the release of the stay. And then the sale has to be set within a certain time period thereafter. The questions which arise, and there's a divergence of opinion in the legal community about exactly whether that notice of amended sale must include the recitation of the defaults that exist at the time the stay was lifted, or should it just reiterate the defaults that existed at the beginning of the foreclosure? And the purpose of this part of this bill is to clarify that the trustee should recite what the existing defaults are that need to be cured in order to stop the foreclosure if the borrower has the resources to do so. A second important question is, can a sale that is set under an amended notice of sale be postponed in the same way that a foreclosure sale that just is beginning from the beginning can be postponed? Under the current statute, if the trustee wants to postpone a sale from time to time, that can be done for a period of up to 180 days from the original sale date. Under legislation that was passed last year, there's some notice requirements that were added to the statute, but basically the sale can be postponed from time to time up to that maximum 180-day period. The question we're trying to solve with this statute is, can the same procedure be followed on this amended notice of sale that comes a long time after the original scheduled sale date, but after the release from the stay? And we worked as a committee with various interest groups to come up with a solution to that problem, which is in the statute that provides that, as the administrator recited, the sale can be postponed again from time to time, following the same notice procedures that are in the current law for up to 60 days or the remainder of the 180-day period that was not used before the state was put in place. Finally, there's one other important point that I want to bring to the committee's attention with regard to the language with regard to the postponement procedure. And those of us in the area discovered that after the enactment of Senate Bill 1552 in the last session, there were some ambiguities laden in that legislation with regard to what sort of notice is required to be given when a trustee postpones the sale. And again, working with constituency, both in representing debtors and creditors, we came up with some language to clarify that the type of notice that was intended to be made was the same sort of notice or giving a notice that was provided for the original notice of sale under ORS 86740. So I think that sums up the main points of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Due to time constraints, and I know that this bill is going to probably have much more discussion later on, as we have several foreclosure bills, and we're going to move pretty cautiously with all of those to make sure we don't have a lot of overlapping bills
on these ideas, but I do want to open up House Bill 2569 for public hearing so I can allow you to testify on that and try to move my agenda along a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Hulvey and members of the committee, my name is Patrick Wade. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Eugene. As I mentioned before, I represent both primarily creditors, but occasional debtors as well. This bill clarifies the ability of a trustee to utilize another lawyer in the same office if the trustee is a lawyer to execute certain documents that are required or permitted to be executed by the trustee. Frequently, under the current statute, a individual Oregon lawyer may be appointed as a trustee under a trustee. And if that's the case, then if, for example, in a foreclosure setting, certain notices have to be given periodically during the time of the foreclosure. Notices have to be sent to occupants and to property owners and other interest holders in the property. Can those notices be executed by another lawyer in the same office? And again, there's a divergence of opinion in the legal community on what should or should not be the case, and this bill is intended to clarify that another lawyer in the same office should be authorized to execute whatever documents the trustee is required to execute. A second part of this bill would also permit the law firm itself, as opposed to an individual lawyer, to be designated as the trustee. And again, the authority to sign documents would be for any lawyer in the office, member of the Oregon Bar, with authority from the trustee to sign those documents. In this regard, during the weeks prior to the this hearing, there had been some discussion about the bill in the committee, and we came up with some clarifications to language, and part of my written testimony today includes some proposed amendments, which we would be submitting to the Legislative Council following this hearing to clarify or make the language that we came up with a little tidier with regard to the definition of a law firm and exactly how the person signing the document would demonstrate the authority that that person has to sign the document.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I'm going to, I don't see any burning questions.
Very quick.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you for coming. One would be the cost to a client if you have double representation from the same law firm. Would you therefore be able to double bill, you know, because you have two people in the same law firm that are signing in their different capacities, and the other is whether or not it makes sense for a law firm to be the party, since law firms can come and go, you know, they dissolve and other things, where individual attorneys are individually responsible for the work product regardless of what law firm they may be in.
Great. Thank you, Chair Hulvey and Vice Chair Richardson. I don't think that would be a concern with regard to the first part of your question with regard to billing. I can speak from our own experience that, you know, when we have matters in our firm and one lawyer is working on it, you know, that time that lawyer spends is billed by that lawyer, and if another lawyer is doing something, that lawyer is going to be billing that time. But there's only one charge for the work that gets done, so if a notice has to go out on a particular day, you know, that time and expense for that notice is billed, and it doesn't make any difference whether A does it or B does it in the grand scheme of things. And with regard to a law firm, certainly law firm entities do change over time. Some law firms dissolve and so forth. Of course, that same possibility exists with regard to any of the other entities that are authorized to be trustees in the current law. Financial institutions, we know, come and go. Insurance companies, title insurance companies that are authorized to be trustees come and go. and there are ways to deal with that problem. If there's no immediate successor, then the fallback position would be that the beneficiary would have to simply appoint another successor trustee.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today, and we'll take a look at the proposed amendments coming forward, and probably come back to this bill on a future date. So I appreciate you coming forward today. Have safe travels back to Eugene.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Jessica Adamson and Sybil Hebb. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2569. We still are open under House Bill 2568. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson, here today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. In deference to your schedule, we'll just want to put a quick word in support for House Bill 2568, and big thank you to Mr. Wade and the work of the State Bar Debtor Creditor Section for working on this important piece of legislation. We represent the folks that do much of the background work that makes closing a mortgage and transferring titles all possible. Members' interest is in making sure that that process is clear and easy so that there's no confusion, so that this process works smoothly. We found in particular that the notice provisions that Mr. Wade spoke about have been a particular problem. There's been confusion about how that notice of postponement has needed to be provided, resulting in significant delays, and has been a real problem for our industry. This bill fixes that and makes other important adjustments, and we just want to commend it to you for your consideration as soon as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Richardson, members of the committee, and Vice Chair Lively, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today to testify also in support of House Bill 2568. We really appreciate the work of the bar and of Mr. Wade in reaching out to the Law Center and to some of our colleagues to seek feedback and input on the drafting. We do agree there were some confusions in some previous language, and we've cleared that up in a way that we think is appropriate for borrowers and also reasonably efficient for lenders, and so we appreciated the opportunity to participate in that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from this panel? I appreciate you coming forward and getting something on the record, and I think we may end up having another public hearing on this bill in the future. So with that, thank you very much. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2568. And I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2060. Bob, why don't you give us a preview of this bill and where we're at with it, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2060 allows the Attorney General to issue order disqualifying charitable organization that fails to expend at least 30% of expenses on program services from receiving tax-deductible contributions, requires the disqualified organization to disclose when soliciting the contributions are not deductible for income tax purposes. We have a revenue statement issued that is available in OLIS, and the fiscal impact on the original bill is minimal. There is also a proposed Dash 2 amendment to 2060, which adds a provision eliminating the property tax exemption for an organization disqualified from receiving deductible charitable contributions.
And the status on a fiscal on that amendment?
Mr. Chair, we do not have fiscal and revenue on the Dash 2 amendment at this time.
Thank you. I'd like ask Aaron Knott or the Department of Justice to come up just for a moment.
With your brief, I'd ask Elizabeth Graham also.
Oh, well, please. Yeah.
Thank you.
I should have said Aaron Knott and the Department of Justice. I appreciate you coming forward and committee. I don't know if you've had time to look at the information that the Department of Justice sent out to us in regards to some of the issues that came up at the first hearing, and I just wanted an opportunity for them to discuss that. I don't know if they're prepared to discuss the Dash 2 amendment, but I know John Phillips from the Department of Revenue is here as well on perhaps that, if we have any specific questions about that process. So I'm just opening this up to address any issues somebody might have or any questions about the information they've received. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me, I'm reading the measure description, and it says, allows the Attorney General to issue an order disqualifying a charitable organization from receiving contributions that otherwise would be deductible. Can you just walk me through how that would work, both with an in-state nonprofit designated 501c3 from the IRS and an out-of-state?
Do you want to take that one?
Can you help me with that?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith. Yes.
And if you'd identify yourself.
Oh, yes. My name is Elizabeth Grant. I'm the attorney in charge of the charitable activities section at the Department of Justice. And to address your question, all organizations, both in-state and out-of-state organizations that are soliciting here in Oregon or soliciting donations from Oregonians, are required to file annual financial reports with our office. And then we would take the data from those reports to identify the charities, both charities based in Oregon and charities based out of state, to identify those charities that fall below the threshold specified in the bill.
Okay. So just so I'm clear, because of the IRS determines their nonprofit status, if they failed to spend at least 30% on the process, they would still be eligible to be classified as a nonprofit with the IRS, but in Oregon they would not be able to collect, but would still be able to operate.
Chair Holvey and Representative Smith, yes, the law allows any of the nonprofits that might be affected by the legislation could still continue to solicit, and because we can't impact the federal tax ramifications of the legislation or of the tax deductibility, the effect of the tax, the disqualification would affect Oregon income taxes only.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That really helped me.
Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that the first sentence might be very confusing because it sounds like you're disqualifying a charitable organization from receiving contributions. It's the tax deductible nature. You're not allowing them to have of the contributions.
Right.
So it's a confusing. Right. It could be worded better. From receiving state tax deductions from contributions.
There you go.
This says it's disqualifying from receiving contributions.
Mm-hmm.
No, they can still receive contributions from Oregon residents. They just can't get the tax deductible.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer. It's true that they would still be able to get contributions from Oregonians, but that particular organization would not be eligible to receive tax-deductible contributions from Oregonians.
So you just have to add that piece. Right now, it looks like it's prohibited from receiving contributions. It's a confusing sentence. I think it could be clarified.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer, we could take a look at the legislation. I'm not sure if that's the summary of the legislation that's confusing.
You're speaking of the
summary. I'm speaking of the summary, that's all.
Just the summary is what she's talking about, not the what's in the bill.
Oh, okay.
Right. But it does become a part of the public record, so I think it's important.
Co-chair, or Chair Holvey, members of the committee will modify that.
Yeah. So the question, I guess, that's come up to me that I still haven't really got particularly clear yet either is so you're disallowing the tax deductibility of that contribution or the company from offering that. What happens to the individual who goes ahead thinking that it is tax deductible and sends it in, sends in the contribution to the company that wasn't supposed to be offering the tax-deductible contribution? So how does that impact that individual when he goes to he or she goes to file their taxes and thinks that they have a tax-deductible contribution. What action will happen there?
Well, Chair Holvey, hopefully that situation will be avoided to begin with, because the legislation requires that the organization disclose in the acknowledgement or in the paperwork that the prospective donor receives before the donor even gives the money that the particular donation will not be tax deductible. If the donor does not disregards that or still claims the tax deduction, then in the event of an audit, if the Oregon Department of Revenue discovers that the person has claimed an exemption to which or a donation deduction to which they're not entitled, then it would be that added back into that person's income tax base. And that's sort of true with any charitable deduction. If you give to an organization that you thought was a charity, but turns out that it was not a charity, you won't get credit for that deduction, even if it was an innocent mistake. However, the legislation does provide a safeguard that if the person is able to establish that they got misinformation from the organization about the deductibility, that if the acknowledgement or receipt that the organization provided misled the person and said that the contribution was tax deductible, then they would be eligible to take that deduction. And we would hope that that information would be reported to us, because that means that the organization that provided that was violating the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. But that is a measure of protection for the donors.
Thank you. That does clear up something for me.
So it probably didn't clear it up for me. I don't mean to make this any more complex than it is, but just let me go back. So under this proposal, the person that made, they chose to make the donation, they could still claim it on their federal tax return, so they fill out the form that lists all of these. So it would be listed on there. They'd claim the deduction. Then when they went to fill out their Oregon form, they'd have to change that attachment where it lists all their deductions and how they get the deductions. They'd have to change that and take that back out, because otherwise they'd be claiming that even though, I mean, if they fill it out, because my understanding when you file the long form, that's what you're using. You're using A, isn't it? Isn't it for filling those out? And so I'm just trying to understand the person that's put in this position, because you're saying it's still allowed federally, but it's not allowed in the state, which what complications they have to go through in filing their tax returns to make sure they don't inadvertently even do it.
Well, assuming the taxpayer chose to make the contribution even after receiving the information that it would not be tax deductible in Oregon, then there are, when one fills out their personal tax returns, there's a spot that says what was your federal taxable income. Mm-hmm. And then as it stands now, one must make adjustments to that, because Oregon doesn't necessarily give complete credit for all sorts of federal deductions.
Right.
And so it would be similar to the current system where you end up adding money back into your taxable income for purposes of Oregon.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate this clarification. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Ed. I wasn't actually going to say anything, because I read your information, and I think that it's complete. In it, you say most of these deductions, these contributions are $10 to $20, and my understanding is that most of the contributions to these national companies that get very little are through telephone solicitations, in which you wouldn't know whether it applied or didn't, because somebody calls and says, hey, will you help the vets and give $20? You say, well, okay, what's the name of the organization? And you write that down. You may not get the disclaimer. You wouldn't know if you did or didn't, or even who was calling you. Mm-hmm. Also, if it's in writing, I've seen these before, and so you have this, help the vets, blah, 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 and then in real small print, it'll say, may not be deductible or not subject or questionable or something in New York, Oregon, in here, just be Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could say, we gave them notice.
Mm-hmm.
And if they still gave it to us, it's their business. And then we go to the tax return, and we've got to say, okay, well, not the federal, and not, okay, on the federal, but not on the state. I just say, to me, this is a problem looking for a solution. We're the only state that would be doing this. It's already approved to the IRS. The accountants would have to check things over, which is going to cost more money for the system. And I think that it is de minimis. It is not a big enough problem for us to be looking for a solution that's worth going through all these hoops.
All right. Chair Holley, just asking permission to speak. Chair Holley, Representative Richardson. I want to push back on that a bit. And in the materials that I supplied, the supplementary materials that came out just yesterday, so I'm not sure if everyone got them. I hope that they did, and I'm glad that you did, Representative. A point that I wanted to emphasize is that we think 2050 de minimis, but the charitable donations market generally has taken a real hit since 2007. It's lower at that point than it had been in 50 years. And a point that I want to emphasize to the committee about the effect this can have within the nonprofit community is that a national nonprofit that has the ability to invest 90% of what they take into a non-charitable purpose, in addition to overhead, salaries, and those sorts of things, are also empowered to invest in advertising. That's going to give them a comparative advantage, and I think a real one, over the nonprofits that are donating more directly to a charitable purpose. So even though the monetary impact might seem small, I think there's some competitive impacts here that could be a little bit more significant. And so while we think 2050 impact on a taxpayer, we're going through a lot of work. Some of this is about the culture of nonprofits themselves. I'd remind the committee that we had the support of nonprofits when we brought this forward. They did testify on behalf of this bill, and I think the reason for that is what I just illustrated. Not only does this damage the reputation of nonprofits, because I would submit consumers don't know about this, because as you just represented, there's no good way for them to find out. And when they do, I think that can cause some betrayal and a reluctance to donate in the future. But I also think in the way that nonprofits have to jostle for these very limited monies, it can encourage bad behavior. Anything you want to add?
Mr. Chair, just in closing, the examples that were given to us before were two charities from other states, one that grossed nationally $5 million, the other $2 million. And so their advertising budget, when compared to multi-hundred million dollar charities, is probably not a threat. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do what we can to inform people about charities that are abusing this thing. It's just what is being proposed here to me is not ripe. I mean, it is more complicated than the benefit that's going to be received when it's such a small amount that's at stake, small companies. It's just my thought on it.
Thank you. I'd like to see if John Phillips would be willing to come up just for and join you. You don't have to leave just for a moment and talk to us a little bit about the Dash 2 amendment. I know that you've had a chance to look at it, and our committee has it, and it's certainly another addition to this, because it was brought to my attention this morning that there are actually a few nonprofits in Oregon who would fall under this 30% mark and actually do have property in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. Haven't talked for an hour or so. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. And for charities in the property tax, the theory is generally that if a charity provides a service to the public that relieves the government of providing that service, that's a benefit. And so the benefit is paid back in some respects by offering an exemption from property taxes. So theoretically, that's what it's about. And it seemed like, in many cases, there is a difficulty in finding the bright line for that. What amount of charity or what is the real charity, and what is really relieving government? This particular idea seems to set up a bright line, and we can all discuss whether that's the correct line or not, but it seems to be a good tie for the property tax to say that if a charitable organization is getting a property tax benefit and there's a decision made by the Department of Justice under these provisions that it's not really providing a lot of charity, then maybe that's a good bright line for this narrow test. I think that that what I've heard is there's not a lot of Oregon charities that have property in Oregon, but there are some. So is this a huge change? No, but it would give support to those charities that are actually doing good with their donations for Oregonians.
Thank you. I appreciate that, committee. And we're not going to move the bill today, but I would like to take a motion on adopting the Dash 2 amendment into this bill at this point.
And we'll be able to discuss this further on the main bill. But Representative Lively.
Chair Hovey, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated February 20th, 2013.
And Representative Lively moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2060, dated 220-13. Discussion on the amendment. I'm seeing none. Any objection to the adoption of the Dash 2 amendment? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendment is adopted. I want to thank you again for coming. It is seemingly a simple bill, but obviously has some intricacies in there that are tough to understand, and appreciate your efforts on this. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2060. And Bob, it looks like we just about ran out of time. And so with that, I'm going to carry over the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2059, or we could just we'll just carry it over to our next meeting. And let's carry over House Bill 2060 as well to Tuesday. So with that, I'm going to close the
work session.
I closed the work session already, so I guess I'll just adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.
Adam? No.